So as Harold has said, it's Jewish colonial farming in America, or Jewish agricultural colonies in America, which was an experiment. Now, Harold sent me an email, and he asked me for a picture, and he wrote in the email, "Do you have a picture of a Jewish American farmer? Did such a thing ever exist?" So I want to simply give a little background that farming, agriculture, plays a key role in Judaism. What I'll refer to as the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the five books of Moses, etc., there is much there dealing with farming. There are the various tithes where certain percentages are given. The farmer has to leave the corner of the field for poor people. Gleanings that drop are left for poor people. There is the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, one every seventh year where you're not allowed to farm. And then after 49 years, then there's the Yovel, the 50th year where you're not allowed to farm. There is Tu B'Shvat, which is the new year for the trees. And there is Bikurim, that is the first fruits were brought to the temple in Jerusalem on the Shavuos festival. So clearly farming plays a role in Judaism. When the Jews entered Israel at first, they were primarily an agricultural economy. Even in Babylonia, when most of the Jews resided in Babylonia, they were centered around farming. And in fact, there were 2 months a year when thousands of Jews gathered to study Torah, because those were 2 months when there was nothing to do as farmers. And these were known as what was called Yarche Kala, and this was a big thing. This is when many Jews gathered together in the various yeshivas. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, who I've spoken about, or at least quoted occasionally here, who is in the 19th century, writes in glowing terms about farming and how it allows one time for the study of philosophy of Torah, etc. Now, this changed with time due to discrimination. And indeed, starting probably in the Middle Ages, Jews were actually banned from farming. They weren't allowed. In fact, many professions were closed to Jews. Let me just share with you a little something. I spoke here once about a gentleman named Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman, 1861 to 1944. He was born in America. He went to Europe. He went to Germany to study for the rabbinate. And he went in 1882. And while he was there, he went to visit some relatives of his in a little town called Nordheim. It's a small village. And his relatives were farmers. And he writes, first of all, glowingly about the religious life there. And then he writes the following: "Much of my respect and reverence went to the memory of one who no longer walked among the living, but whose spirit hovered unseen over Nordheim, and whose influence, even after his departure from earth, was undoubtedly responsible for the profoundly religious sentiment not only of his own descendants, but of the entire Jewish community of Nordheim and the surrounding country. It was my grandfather, the father of my mother, and of the uncle couple in whose home I was now sojourning, Rabbi Shmaria Stein, affectionately known as Reb Shmaria. He had been educated for the rabbinate, but he had never taken it up as a vocation. Just when Reb Shmaya had received his smicha, that is his rabbinical ordination, and was about to become a husband of the daughter of the rabbi of a place called Fulda, a political event occurred of the highest importance to the Jews of Bavaria." Now, Bavaria was a very anti-Semitic place. There were laws in Bavaria beginning in about 1820-something in which only the oldest son was allowed to marry. The other sons were not allowed to marry unless they paid an exorbitant fee. Jews were banned from virtually every profession except cattle dealing and something else. And many Jews came, German Jews came to America from Bavaria. But anyway, this occurred somewhat later. "This event, though good in itself, destroyed Reb Shmaria's romance and completely changed the course of his life." What happened? The medieval laws, which had hitherto prevailed in Bavaria, forbade the ownership of land by persons of the Jewish faith. Thus, no Jew could be a tiller of the soil. But the breath of liberalism had begun to stir in Europe, and it reached even the corner of Germany in which Reb Shmaya dwelt. The Bavarian government repealed the prohibitory law and announced that henceforth Jews would be permitted to own and till land, the same as all other citizens. It was truly liberal, a liberal legislative act, accentuated by an undeniable humane purpose. Jews, however, were loath to take advantage of it. They had no experience with farming. It was a total life change. They had become unfamiliar with agriculture for centuries. They therefore hesitated to exchange the communal pursuits, which most of them followed, for the calling of peasant, which stood in some disrepute and was deemed lower than that of the merchant or the scholar. But this grandfather of his decided that he wanted to be a farmer. And he took the money that he had and he bought a small farm in Nordheim. Now, when his future father-in-law learned of this, he refused to allow the marriage. So he lost his betrothed. But it was so important to him that he bought the farm and others followed him. So there were, for example, in Germany, this is in 1882, he's writing, there were Jews who were involved in farming. So farming is not so strange to Jews, although, again, it was almost unheard of because of discriminatory laws. Now, let's turn to America and let's talk about experiments in farming in America and why these things came about and what was going on. First of all, the first agricultural colony in America is in 1837. It was in Wawarsing, or Wawarsing, in Ulster County, New York. And the place was named Shalom Peace. 13 Jewish families settled there under the leadership of Moses Cohen. The land was divided into lots of 5 acres, and a site was selected for a village. Contracts were awarded to build houses at the cost of $400. Now, I wrote an article about this, and the people in the paper wanted me to convert all these numbers, these dollar amounts, from 1881 and 1882 into amounts today. So when they sent that to me, the editor sent that to me, I said, which way do you want me to do it? And I sent her to a website in which there are at least 5 different ways. And they differ drastically. Anyway, they decided, don't ask me why, to use what's called the unskilled wage rate. So $400 in 37, is about $74,000 in 2008 dollars. That's what the website goes to, 2008. So it gives you, it was money, it was money. The settlers requested that Congregation Anshei Chesed in New York loan them a Sefer Torah, that is a scroll of the law, until they could secure one from Europe, and they also asked for lamps for the synagogue. The newcomers cleared the land and built roads. For 5 years, they tried to make farming pay, but circumstances forced them to add to their earnings from the produce of the land by manufacturing and trading. Notwithstanding, the colony carried on. The climax, however, came when the factories in the neighborhood were shut down. After a few years of further struggling, the settlers found it impossible to continue. They sold their belongings in 1842, and they moved away, and that was the end of that first attempt. I think there's still something there marking the place, although I have not seen it. This is 1837. Now we jump ahead to the 1880s. We have to understand what's going on in Russia during the 1880s. Let's also understand that beginning in 1881, a huge number of Jews began to migrate, to get out of Russia, to come to America, because the conditions there were intolerable. Jews were discriminated against. They weren't allowed to live in certain places. You couldn't live beyond what was called the pale. They couldn't be involved in occupations. Many Jews, there were double taxes for Jews, etc., etc., etc. So Russian Jewry was looking to get out, and indeed between 1881 and 1927, I think, when they shut off the doors of immigration, over 2 million Jews came from Eastern Europe to America. That's a huge, huge number, 2 million Jews, huge, huge number. And by the way, coming here was not easy. And when you got here, it wasn't easy. Anyway, so Jews felt, most Jews came and settled in the big cities. But there was a feeling that Jews should go back to the soil. And there were movements about this. People became enamored with this, the back to the soil movement and the idea of Jews again becoming farmers and again having places where they grew things, etc. They also was felt that since the Jews were not, quote-unquote, gainfully employed in anything physical, this was one of the reasons for anti-Semitism, that people felt that because they didn't, quote-unquote, do anything in the real sense of the word, that this was a reason for anti-Semitism. The fact of the matter is the reason why they didn't do anything because they weren't allowed to do anything. So there was a period of severe persecution and pogroms that followed the assassination of Alexander II in 1881, and it gave these theories of returning to the land a certain impetus. And there were two organizations that made their appearance, something called Am Olam and Bilu. One of them, Am Olam, was interested in immigration to America. The other one was interested in immigration to Palestine. And the grandiose schemes and plans of the Am Olam groups therefore caught the imagination of the Jewish masses, and Eastern European Jewry eagerly awaited the results of these attempts at colonization. Now, the Jews here in America, history repeats itself. What can I say? The first Jews who came to America, they arrived here in 1654. They were a mixture. They were primarily Sephardim, those are Jews from Portugal and Spain, but there were some Ashkenazim, those are Jews from European countries. But the majority of Jews were Sephardim. Many of them were Muranos. They had been persecuted in Portugal and Spain. They lived as secret Jews. They came here and they were able to live openly as Jews. They became involved in America and they looked down on the Ashkenazim. And then there began to come, in the 1830s, the Jews from Bavaria, German Jews. They were looked down upon by those Jews who were here, but eventually they became acclimated, they became successful here, and now the Russian Jews are coming. And of course the German Jews look down on the Russian Jews. Indeed, there were movements to send them back to Russia. There was a society in Baltimore that raised money to send them back to Russia. Why? Well, they came from a very primitive environment. They were quote unquote uncouth in terms of American ways. Many of them, or not many, but some of them had excellent religious educations, but they didn't fit. So they weren't welcomed with open arms. And American Jewish leaders wanted the Jews to be integrated into the American society and to found a colony where Jews would live separately and would raise crops and farm was not an integration into American society. So most of the leaders of American Jewry at the time in the 1880s weren't at all in favor of this idea. We're going to talk about a couple of colonies. Actually, there were a total of about 25 colonies scattered in America, Louisiana and in South Dakota, in New Jersey, in Colorado, and several other places. Every one of them ended up as an abysmal failure. The ones in New Jersey tended to last somewhat longer. They lasted into the beginning of the 20th century, but again, they were a disaster. So the first one that that occurred was in a place called Sicily Island in Louisiana of all places. Don't ask me why that was chosen. I don't know. The first agricultural colony of Russian Jews was founded under the leadership of Herman Rosenthal on Sicily Island in Louisiana in 1881. It comprised 35 families from Kiev and 25 from Yeltsingrad. The colonists were recruited from three classes of immigrants. The first consisted of young idlers, so they felt that this was the thing to do. Then there were professionals who looked upon colonization as an ideal, and the third group were just a mishmash of people who decided this might be a good idea. The colonists were not very enthusiastic about the choice of location. Louisiana was not known to most of the colonists, and the climatic conditions did not appeal to them. They, however, had no choice in the matter, as the land was selected without their knowledge. And by the way, this is a pattern in these things, that the people were told, go here. And where they were sent was not the best place to farm. In fact, in many cases, they were lousy places to farm. The Jewish community of New Orleans enthusiastically supported this project and supplied assistance in a variety of ways. Within a few days of the arrival of the immigrants in New Orleans, the men left their families there and departed for the colony. The colonists were cordially welcomed by the citizens of, it was in Catahoula Parish, who promised them protection and cooperation. The colonists divided in groups and set to work. A German farmer was employed as advisor. The colonists were quartered in three big houses. But as the dwellings were found unsuitable, the New Orleans Jewish community built 12 others. The colonists worked hard and anticipated good results. And in appreciation of the cooperation shown by the New Orleans Jewish community, the colonists wrote a letter of thanks to the president of the New Orleans Association. It looked good, looked promising, looked like it was going to be a good deal. Work progressed. They fenced the grounds, they planted corn and vegetables, they cut down trees, they planted fruit trees, they repaired roads, they dug wells, they built three two-room cottages. A governing board was elected and a constitution was framed, and there was a glowing report in something called the American Israelite in March 24, 1882. Looked great. The colonists themselves were very optimistic, and some of them wrote to their friends in Russia, urging them to select Louisiana as their home. However, with the approach of spring, things began to change. The colonists began to complain about the heat. No air conditioning, don't forget, in those days. Okay? They were disappointed that their wives could not join them. Malaria began its ravages. And to top it all, the Mississippi River rose and swept away practically everything. The New Orleans community was willing to continue its aid, but the colonists were discouraged. Most of the colonists scattered, abandoning everything they had left to take up peddling and factory work. This, in brief, is the story of Sicily Island. So, one down. It was a disaster. It was a disaster. It was a sadness. It was a disaster. Next one we'll talk about is South Dakota. In spite of this failure, Herman Rosenthal, who was the leader of the Louisiana colony, remained convinced that the establishment of agricultural colonies would help solve the economic difficulties of many Jewish immigrants. Let's understand that when Jewish immigrants came here, most of them had no skills. They went to work in sweatshops. They were crammed into the Lower East Side. If you want to get an idea of what it was to live in the Lower East Side, there is something called a tenement housing, something you can go on a tour, tenement museum, and it's an eye-opener. It's an eye-opener, okay? It's an eye-opener. There weren't proper bathroom facilities. There weren't proper anything. It was a terrible, and they were crammed in to these small apartments, and they barely eked out a living. What they were able to do was they seemed to be able to, or what was the key to for many of them, where their children went to public school and they got educations, and from there was no limit. But the immigrants themselves had a terrible time. They had a terrible time. So if you could get them out of the terrible city, get them into the fresh air, get them to be farmers, then it seemed ideal. So this, again, was a goal. So... So 20 Russian families in July of 1882 decided to settle in the southeastern part of what is now South Dakota and formed a colony that they called Krimu. I don't know why. Do you know what that word means? He's not paying attention. Okay, it's okay. I asked you a question about a friend. Krimu? Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were asking somebody else.
No, who else would I ask if not? C-R-E-M-I-E-U-X. M-I-E-U-X. Okay. It was situated in Davidson County, 14 miles from Mount Vernon, the nearest railroad station, and 26 miles... I don't pronounce French, so, you know, I butchered it.
M-I-E-U.
E-U.
Yeah,
E-U. E-U-X.
Yeah, Camus. Camus. Camus.
Why that?
The derivative of cream.
Okay. Camus. Okay. Anyway.
It is French.
Yes, it is French. That I saw by the, over the E. That much I knew. So this was situated 14 miles from Mount Vernon, the nearest railroad station, and 26 miles from Mitchell, the county seat. This was part of the problem. They were isolated. They couldn't get things. Most of the colonists had quarter-section farms of 160 acres. Among the settlers were several families that had joined the ill-fated settlement in Louisiana. These colonists had some means of their own. The first year, they met with a fair measure of success. Oats, wheat, rye, and barley were sown and yielded good crops, while especial attention was paid to the raising of flax. In the second year, wheat was more extensively cultivated, but the wheat bug made its appearance, and a large part of the crop was destroyed. In addition to this, a prolonged period of drought caused the death of many cattle. In the third year, thunderstorms were so destructive to the standing crops that the colonists were compelled to mortgage their farms. But the rate of interest demanded on loans was so high that most of the settlers sold out and moved away. A few remained a year or two longer, but excessive interest on their mortgages and a scarcity of water proved the combination too powerful for them. And in the latter part of 1885, they also left the settlement. The failure may likewise be attributed in a measure to the distance of the colony from the railroad and the county seat. So here's another disaster. Another disaster. It just seems that nature and the location and various other things were working against this. And then the final one that we're going to talk about is a place in Colorado called Cotopaxi, C-O-T-O-P-A-X-I. Which I had never heard of until I became interested in this. And this colony has become quite famous, and because it was kind of a grand experiment that really went down the drain, Cotopaxi is today a small, unincorporated village located on the banks of the Arkansas River. It was given its unusual name by Henry Thomas, a 19th century prospector who was called Gold Tom by his contemporaries. When Thomas arrived in this area of the upper Arkansas Valley in about 1872, he was particularly struck by one of the valleys. He felt it closely resembled an area of northern Ecuador where he had once prospected for gold. The dominant feature of this Andean region was a volcano called Cotopaxi, so Thomas gave this area of Colorado the same name. So it's Cotopaxi. Now, we need to bring in a cast of characters to understand exactly what happened. The first person is Shoal or Saul Bear Milstein. Saul Milstein. Saul Milstein was a well-to-do businessman, a warehouse owner who resided in Brisk Litovsk, that's in Russia, in Lithuania, during the 19th century. During the 1860s and 1870s, he witnessed short periods of brief liberalization of Russia's policies toward the Jews that were always followed by increased government oppression. He came to the conclusion that the only solution for him and his family was migration to America. Therefore, in the late 1870s, he sent his nephew Jacob to New York in order to scout out the political attitudes of America towards Jews, to find out about the Homestead Act and locate land. In addition to this, a search was made to seek out interested relatives and friends for the eventual immigration. Saul Milstein planned to sell his business in order to finance the endeavor once the appropriate arrangements were made. So he sent the scout ahead. However, the scout kind of double-crossed him, unfortunately. Funded by his uncle, Jacob arrived in New York City in 1878 to begin his investigation, but within the first year, he broke his uncle's trust by coaxing Saul's daughter, Yenta, to join him in America so they could be married. Saul was furious at this and immediately cut off all the funds to his nephew, and Jacob was forced to find work in a tin factory in New York City in order to survive. Jacob was involved in some sort of a factory accident, and he suffered a lengthy recovery. During this recovery in 1880, he met a gentleman by the name of Michael Halperin, who was a leader in the Jewish community who was instrumental in establishing HIAS, that's the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society. It played a key role in helping immigrants when they came here. This friendship was one of the factors that eventually led to the establishment of the colony at Cotopaxi, because Jacob got Halpern interested in this idea of Jewish colonies. Now we have to bring in the next gentleman. A gentleman named Emanuel H. Saltiel, S-A-L-T-I-E-L, or he's sometimes known as Shaltiel, S-H-A-T-I-E-L. This gentleman is 1844, 1845 to 1900. He was a Sephardic Jew, a Jew of Portuguese descent, who had become a successful entrepreneur in Colorado during the 1880s. When he learned that Michael Halpern of HIAS was trying to encourage Russian immigrants to leave the crowded urban areas such as New York City and settle in the West, he wrote a glowing, eloquent letter to him, telling him that the place for them to come is Cotopaxi. And he's going to supply whatever's needed for the colony, and he made promises. Okay, he would keep the costs for each person under $10,000, and all the colonists would have to raise would be the living expenses and transportation costs en route to Colorado. It seemed perfect. It seemed like a great deal. Here's a well-to-do man in Colorado who says he has land that's really perfect for a colony. He's willing to put up various funds and various other things. So they jumped at it. The deal seemed like a perfect fit. Each family would be indebted for less than $435, and because many of the Russians had experience in farming, I think they had to have that experience by working on the estates of various Gentile landowners in Russia. That's the only place they could have gotten it. Okay, so they decided that this was the thing to do. Also, and there was a plan to do this in a sensible and logical fashion, done out with thought and planning and everything, but this did not happen. The reason is the following, that when Tsar Alexander II was assassinated in 1881, under the rule of Tsar Alexander III, a new set of anti-Semitic repressive laws were passed. And these really clamped down on the Jews. And so those who were planning to go decided it was time to get out of Russia. Let's go to America, what was known as the Golden Medina, that is the Golden Land, where according to some there was gold in the streets. There wasn't any gold in the streets, by the way. I hate to dissuade you, but there just wasn't any gold in the streets here. There were some who became very successful, but most lived in poverty. Okay. So this was a strong impact on the future Cotopaxi colonists. What began as a well-planned and thought-out move became an urgent necessity. The colonists left Russia and were thrown into a massive wave of immigration, which flooded the highest office with thousands of requests for aid and money, for which they were totally unprepared. Thousands of Jews came here and they went to HIAS to get a start, and HIAS didn't have the funds, they couldn't deal with them, etc. Because of the new urgency, the colonists arrived in New York and were sent west without ever having gotten a report back from what was really going on in Cotopaxi. They didn't know what was there. They just had this glowing letter from Saltiel. So they arrived. The people who comprised the Cotopaxi colony in the spring of 1882 were Hasidic Russian Jews. Okay? 63 persons in all. There were 22 heads of family, each of whom was eligible to file on 160 acres of government land. Actually, most of the 63 were members of only three main family clans, consisting of several generations and relatives by marriage. Among these three families, too, there was much intermarriage, and since they married between each other, so they were really all related. They're one big happy, quote unquote, family, and even some who were not directly related were very good friends with those who were part of the main group. So it was a uniform and cohesive group. These 63 religious Jews left New York on May 5, 1882, and arrived in Cotopaxi on May 12th. They took the Continental Railroad, which had been completed by then. Okay? And then reality struck. They thought they were leaving the hardships of Tsarist Russia behind, but as it turned out, they were exchanging the privations of quote-unquote home for new hardships, which included non-arable land, broken promises, and the difficulty of living in a culture where language, religion, and terrain were foreign and inhospitable. Upon arrival in Cotopaxi, the colonists found that not all of the promises had been fulfilled. Four houses had been constructed 2 miles south of town on an arid plateau above Oak Grove Creek, which was both dry and sandy during the summer and roiling with water during periodic spring flooding. Eight more houses were constructed above 8,000 feet on dry, rocky soil where no irrigation water could be acquired. The houses were only about 8 feet square with flat roofs and lacked windows, doors, and chimneys. 20 houses had been promised, but only 12 had been constructed. The houses were unfurnished. Only four of the houses had cooking stoves. This is what Saltiel had given them. The supplies, too, were inadequate. When asked about this, Saltiel explained that labor and building materials were in short supply and were not available locally. He said that they had been sent for, but had been delayed. Shortly after that, Saltiel left on an extended business trip and was absent for several months, leaving the colonists to cope with little more than their personal belongings that they had brought with them from Russia. But what could they do? They were there. They're in the middle of nowhere. They had no choice. Had to make the best of it. Because of the immediate necessity of planting their crops, the colonists decided to move into the unfinished houses. The colonists borrowed plows, horses, seed, and other equipment from somebody named A.S. Hart. Now, Hart is Saltiel's partner, and they own the only store in the region, and they sell you everything at exorbitant prices, and you mortgage your soul to them to pay it back. They give you credit, but you mortgage your soul. The Jews were extended credit for the purchase of food and personal supplies. Rocks were cleared and crops were planted. Chimneys were built and the doorless, windowless houses were made into homes. Even then, it was near the 1st of June before their crops were sown on the windswept slopes below the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, where a good growing season was less than 4 months. So they actually planted late. There were a few happy moments during the first summer in Cotopaxi. A Sefer Torah, that's a scroll of the law, was donated to the colonists by the New York Orphan Asylum, and the colonists were able to locate an abandoned building north of the general store to use as a synagogue. The dedication of the synagogue on June 23rd, which happens to be my birthday, by the way, held a mystical and divine quality and was described with these words in an account sent to the Jewish Messenger. That's one of the publications of the time in 1882. The young secretary, Julius Schwartz, opened the ark and after the chanting of several hymns, placed the Torah, that's the scroll, in its place. Later, they danced in their peculiar Russian manner, and the silent moon sent its silvery rays upon the dancing and singing Russians. So, looked like it was okay. However, unfortunately, the joy that the colonists experienced during the summer soon came to an end with the onset of an early frost. This put an end to the growing season, the result being that the colonists did not have a profitable harvest. The colonists, already strapped for cash, were forced to turn to other work in order to pay off the debts they had incurred when they purchased farming supplies from the store owned by Saltiel and his partner Hart. They also needed to purchase food and clothing for the upcoming winter. Many of the men, they took jobs as laborers in either Saltiel's mines, because Saltiel owned mines, and one of the claims was that the reason why Saltiel wanted these people there, because he needed workers in his mines. That was his whole reason for this. Okay. But they weren't paid in money. They were paid in vouchers for use in Hart's store. In addition to crop failure, the colonists were forced to use their winter supply of firewood for large bonfires to keep away the marauding bears. The extra houses, never having been completed, forced two families to set up camp in canvas tents. Must have been fun in a winter in Colorado when a canvas tent. And another family to spend their first year in an Indian dugout cave. During the first winter, the weather was severe, and the starving Utah Indians frequently visited begging for food. Eventually, many of the men went to work for the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad. There, they were able to get paid. At this time, it was extending its line west from Salida. They receive $3 a day, by the way, which is a huge sum of money in today's money, even no matter which way you calculate it. It's good money. It's good money. As track laborers, the job held two benefits for the colonists. The first was that the railroad was happy to give them the Sabbath off in exchange for working on Sunday, which was, these were all religious Jews. They were all religious Jews. And the second was that once the trained firemen, conductors, and engineers learned of the colonists' plight, they threw extra coal from the train along the track, along the tracks near Cotopaxi, so that the women from the colony could gather it to use for heat through the long, harsh winter. By the fall of 1882, it was clear that the colonists would need outside help. The promises Saltiel had made for the additional houses and supplies were never met. Who comes to the rescue? The Jews of Denver. There's a Jewish community in Denver. They hear about the plight. They're concerned. They send people to see what's going on. They report terrible conditions, and they say, we must do something to help these people. So they supplied them with various things. They supplied them with food, clothing, medicine, and other necessities. So they managed to survive their first winter. But they faced the coming spring with determination not to make the same mistakes nor rely on Saltiel for any further assistance. They had had it with him. They observed their first Passover at Cotopaxi that April of 1883. Some of the men walked 26 miles to Salida to purchase the flour they needed to bake matzahs. That's the unleavened bread that's used on the Passover festival. They sowed crops, but nature seemed to conspire against them. For scarcely were the seeds in the ground when a late spring blizzard ruined a large part of them. These late storms are common in Colorado, but to the struggling and discouraged colonists, it seemed a special punishment directed at them alone. Their harvest then of 1883 was no better than the harvest that they had before, and things looked hopeless. Some already began to leave. They felt there was no sense of it. Those who stayed on that winter earned their living expenses by working in the neighboring mines and on the railroad. The colony celebrated second Passover at Cotopaxi in 1884, shortly after which a number of families left for new locations. Only six families decided to remain and plant the third crop, but when another late blizzard destroyed it, they at last recognized the futility of persevering in this spot, and they made plans to abandon it. Now, interesting, each family had paid a fee so that they would have the rights to the land that they were farming. And they thought that they owned it. But when they went to investigate, they discovered that nothing was registered in their name. It was a scam. Whether it was done because the person who was supposed to register these plots of land didn't understand the language that they spoke, or whether this was simply a scam, in any case, they ended up with bubkas, as we say in Yiddish. They ended up with nothing. With nothing. They had absolutely nothing for their efforts. By June of 1884, the colony as such was formally dissolved. The Cotopaxi colony had become a failure, but it had served to give its members valuable lessons in pioneering and had taken them out of the crowded ghettos of the eastern cities and given them a glimpse at what was available on other farmlands in the west. Of the 22 families who lived through the bitter but edifying experience at Cotopaxi, only two failed to remain in the west. The rest used their hard-won knowledge to try farming on better lands in the West. Now, who is really to blame for the Cotopaxi failure? Saltiel looks like the villain, but it's subject to argument. I'll explain what I mean by that. Two completely different points of view emerged, according to Flora Satt in her master's thesis detailing the history of the colony. By the way, it's available on the internet. It's amazing what's available on the internet, particularly if you're interested in old stuff. Old stuff, old books, it's all there. It's great for me. Okay? In her master's thesis about the history of the colony, the Denver Republican pinned the blame on Salty, emphasizing his unsavory character, and they blamed the highest for sending the colonists into a situation which had not been fully researched ahead of time. A second newspaper, the Rocky Mountain News, downplayed the situation by saying that all pioneers must endure some hardship. They believed the colonists were not facing anything more difficult than other settlers and felt they were far better off than most. There has been much debate about why the Jewish colonists of Cotopaxi did not succeed. Poor timing, poor preparation, poor weather, poor funding, the cultural and language barrier, and the role played by Emmanuel Saltiel have all been questioned. If any one of these things had been different, would the colony have been a success? We don't know. In a recent paper, a descendant of Saltiel, Miles Saltiel, defends Emmanuel Saltiel as a somewhat, he calls him, rumbustious, but well-intended benefactor. He points out that there were no other cases of successful agricultural colonies in the United States during that time period. It's true. Everyone failed. And Saltiel was not involved in any of them but this one. So there's something was going on that was fundamentally wrong. Okay, perhaps this is so, but if nothing else, Emmanuel Saltiel influenced the placement of the colony with his letter to Hyas extolling the virtues of Cotopaxi and by promising to provide adequate housing and equipment to enable the colonists a good start. When asked for help, Saltiel at one point simply shrugged. Another lingering question regards the land that the colonists expected to eventually own through the Homestead Act. It is said the colonists were taken by wagon to Cannon City to file declarations, but these turned out to be little more than statements taken by a confused clerk, which gave them no legal entitlement to the land. Because of the language barrier, it is unclear what understanding they had of the filing process or if anyone told them how to properly apply for the land. Throughout all this, the spirit of these Russian Jews eclipsed the travesty. After the dissolution of the colony, many of them remained in Colorado and became successful farmers and ranchers in places such as Rocky Ford, Longmont, Pueblo, and Montrose. Others moved to Denver and became successful businessmen and leaders in the West Colfax Jewish community. The Cotopaxi colony itself was short-lived, but the legacy of the quote-unquote experiment has survived. The colonists of Cotopaxi proved the pioneer dictum that stepping into the unknown requires courage and faith, and while their journey did not end where they imagined, taking the first step eventually led to the new lives that they desired. So this is the whole story, or part of the story anyway. If there are any questions, I will be glad to attempt to answer them.
Chicken farming.
Vineland, New Jersey.
Right. And I was there in the 1950s.
Yep. Those were World War II refugees who
they
came there.
Left wing secular.
Yes, but some religious. Today there's a brand of kosher chicken called Vineland. And I think that it's still produced in Vineland, New Jersey.
Okay, you probably know that in the second half of the 19th century, many Jews, German Jews, were immigrating to the Lower East Side.
Yeah, okay.
And I suppose you know that the community at that time was known as Kleine Deutschland.
Yes.
And many of those German who were there already were socialists, and they became mentors of Jews.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Okay. Then just a question. Do you know anything about how Jews got out of the Soviet Union during the first 5 or 6 years after the revolution?
No, I don't know. I really don't know.
How my mother got out?
I don't know.
17 to 22.
Maybe many of them snuck out.
What?
Many of them had to sneak out.
I think they were brokers.
Right. Yeah. But I don't have any real information. Anyone else?
Yeah, you gave us three examples, and you said there were 20.
Almost 25.
And
yeah.
You concluded by saying faith, courage. What I got from your three examples, I would have added a bit of planning.
That's true.
That these people were totally naive,
yes,
innocent.
Yes.
And by the way, there were also the French settlers that went in Louisiana also.
Right.
Manipulated by a banker in the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century.
Right.
And it was the same absolute
with disaster. Right.
And I did there, the mosquitoes were that big.
That's right. Yeah.
The
yeah.
land is profuse, etc.
Yeah.
So to me, it seems that.
Yeah.
They were going in the
There were lambs that came for the slaughter to some extent. Yes. Now, some of them, you know, benefited from that in the sense, some of them rebounded from that. And those who were there in Kodaba, many of them became successful later on.
But
the experience was terrible. Yes. I don't want to minimize that. I agree with you. Yes.
There's a parallel, though, with the Russians making the first and second aliyah to Israel, and that they were also told this is a land flowing with milk and honey, and they got there and were full of swamps filled with malaria. But the beginning kibbutzim in Israel were also, you know, people died, and the swamps refused to be drained, and there were, you know, the malaria killed them, but they persevered. And some of the first kibbutzim were abandoned, and then they were built someplace else later on. So there's a parallel there, but the perseverance and the impetus to build the land.
Yes.
Came. And I was wondering if perhaps the socialist ideal of a kibbutz and the communal ownership of the property may have helped them persevere as opposed to.
I think that those who came, or some of those who came to America, and those who went to what was then Palestine, had the same ideology or influenced by the same ideology. There's no question it seems. I mentioned there were two organizations. One was called Am Olam, which was a movement towards America, and the other is Bilu, which was a movement to Palestine. And there's no question that those who went to Palestine also encountered terrible difficulties, okay, and did persevere under overwhelming odds, okay, but they had something to show for it after a while. Whereas there was nothing to show for it with these colonies, nothing to show for it.
I think the context of the Colorado Plateau and Israel is a little bit different.
But the idea,
the context, you know, of the Colorado Plateau versus Palestine is a little bit different.
Yes, obviously, but I mean, they also encountered malaria-filled
swamps. Well, a lot of people encountered this and that, but I mean,
yeah. But Bernie, the idea that they were going to return to the land.
A similar phenomenon took place in Azerbaijan, where they came and there was nothing, and they went through all these hardships, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't actually. No.
That was the community that was set up in the Soviet Union in eastern Siberia and became a Jewish autonomous district.
Oh, a state. Yes. Now, vaguely.
Only
vaguely.
Yiddish
was spoken there. Yes. Yeah. You had a question, sir?
Yeah. Were the farms in America supposed to be similar to a kibbutz, or was it more like a regular farm? Just happened to be on the
kibbutz? I don't know if it was supposed to be similar to a kibbutz, but it was supposed to be the idea that everybody would come and they would have a community and they would farm together, although each person was supposed to own their farm, which was different than a kibbutz.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know,